Thank you for choosing to listen to Phoenix Fire today. Phoenix Fire features John Anthony West. You can access the Phoenix Fire blog at www.jawphoenixfire.blogspot.com. You can learn more about John Anthony West by going to www.jawest.net. Phoenix Fire!
This is Phoenix Fire, John Anthony West, rogue Egyptologist and mystic in skeptics clothing, broadcasting from West Henge in the wilderness with something to offend everyone. Welcome to the conflagration. Symbolist Egypt, the Egypt of the ancient Egyptians, as opposed to the Egypt of the Egyptologists. Symbolist Egypt is the name applied by both adherents and detractors to the work of the Alsatian mathematician, orientalist, practicing alchemist, the genius with the unpronounceable name R.A. Shvala de Lubitsch. He was born in 1891. And died, I believe, in 62 or 63. And for somebody who lived so recently and who was not hiding his light under a bushel particularly, there's relatively little known of personal details of his life. My own work, most of you listening are probably aware of this, my own work is largely devoted to making Schwaller's magisterial reinterpretation of all of ancient Egypt accessible to a more general audience. Schwaller has only recently been translated out of the French, but in any language, French, English, whatever, he is not an easy read. And since I am a writer by trade rather than a scholar, I believe that I'm able to make his work somewhat more accessible. Even that is not bedtime reading, I'm told. Serpent in the Sky, which is an in-depth introduction to Schwaller's Symbolist Egypt. I am told by people over the years, it's been in print now almost 30 years, people often tell me that they bought the book, it looked so interesting, they picked it up, they started reading, they got into the number symbolism, they gave up, and then they picked it up 6 years later and couldn't understand what the problem was. All of a sudden it was easy. Well, it has something to do with, let's say, inner preparation. But Schwaller, no matter what, is not easygoing, and that's all there is to it. Anyway, in writing my book and writing Serpent in the Sky, I took on myself, I'm self-described as Schwaller's unofficial Boswell, and I took it upon myself to make what I consider possibly the most important single work of scholarship of the 20th century, or maybe any century, you'll see why when we get along further into this program, accessible or at least available to a larger audience, and you'll see why it wasn't available in a minute. Anyway, in doing the work, I worked closely with Schwaller's stepdaughter, Lucy Lamy, in the south of France, and I could never get from her an awful lot of detail about Schwaller's personal life, a few leads, but not much. It was not that he was secretive, it's just that there wasn't an awful lot known. Anyway, Schwaller was born in Alsace-Lorraine in 1891, and moved to Paris as a young man, really a boy, 17, 18. I'm not sure if he moved in with his parents or not, but in Paris, he was brought up, his father was a pharmacist, which in those days was basically the same as being a chemist, you know, a scientist actually, rather than a mere dispenser of pills. And it was a scientific household, and Schwaller was brought up with, he was initially just René Schwaller, and you'll see where the de Lubitsch comes in a second. He was brought up in the scientific household, and he was something of a boy genius. His first mathematical paper was written at the age of 16, and it was a study of Pythagorean mathematics. And in Paris, he was briefly, and I'm not 100% sure of this, he was connected with the Theosophists. At least he was giving lectures there, and he was sort of under their care as the young boy genius. And he befriended a number of people who were well-known in Paris at the time, but do not have much of a reputation outside of Paris and or France of that beginning of the century, and even then, not only to a very specialized audience, but among his friends were some royalties, actually. Matilda Gica, who wrote very learned books on the golden section and on sacred geometry, who was a Romanian prince, and then a Lithuanian prince named and poet, a very extraordinary poet named Oscar V. de Miloš Ljubić. And according to Lucy Lamy, Schwaller's stepdaughter, he took the young René Schwaller under his wing, and Schwaller was able to cure him of a lupus, according to Lucy. A lupus is a terrible autoimmune disease that results in terrible inflammation. It's very difficult to get rid of, even nowadays. I think more success in getting rid of it now, but we're talking about turn of the century here. Anyway, according to Lucy, Schwaller cured de Miloš Ljubić of this disease, and as a reward, the de Miloš Ljubić made him an honorary baron, and therefore he became R.A. Schwaller de Ljubić. And actually, Schwaller was very much into heraldry and royalty. And he wasn't a name dropper, but he liked being a baron, actually. And more stories about that when we get Schwaller into Egypt. I don't know if we'll have time in this particular talk or in this particular program, but maybe we'll see. Anyway, Schwaller was functioning in Paris around the turn of the century, and he got interested, specifically interested in lots of things, actually, in all of the Hermetic tradition of the West, which filters down from ancient Egypt and in ancient metaphysical systems, East and West, and specifically in alchemy, and alchemy as a practice. And without going into a whole program on alchemy, let's just say that the real alchemists were not interested in turning lead into gold in order to have lots of money because the price of gold was going up. Rather, it was a way of anchoring a spiritual process. In other words, the transformation of the base into the fine, of the lead into the gold, was meant for the successful alchemist, and I believe there were some successful alchemists, was meant as a, you might say, like passing the test, that they had actually transformed themselves from a material state to a spiritual state, or some degree of a spiritual state. In any event, Schwaller was a practicing alchemist, and there was it's not as though everybody was doing it, and it was the same as watching American Idol, but there were a number of practicing alchemists. There was a genuine alchemical revival around the turn of the century, mainly in France, but in other countries as well. And kind of a footnote here, there was a book, extremely interesting book, published in the 20s called La Mystère de Cathédrale, and it was translated into English, though retained its French name, but it's now been, I don't know why they did that, the Mystery of the Cathedrals, and the author is Fulcanelli, Fulcanelli, which means little furnace, actually. It's a symbolic name. And this book had a considerable influence. It's been around for a long time, been reprinted. Nobody quite knew who Fulcanelli was, and there were various speculations. It was sort of mysterious. It was thought that Schwaller de Ljubić played a part in this. And just recently, a very interesting book published by Inner Traditions International by a French woman called Geraldine Dubois, called Fulcanelli and the Alchemical Revival. And this details Schwaller's role in this. Things I've never been able to find out. Well, A, I'm not French and I'm not living there, and I had no access to those people. But Fulcanelli and the Alchemical Revival, very interesting book, very well done. And who would have thought that there was an alchemical revival in France or anyone else? This is another one of those aspects of our education that is little short of propaganda. For example, we would have it from our schools that ever since the Renaissance in Italy, science has been taking over and all of this other stuff that people believed in before, magic and astrology and alchemy and all of these things, were sooner rather than later completely abandoned, and anybody with any sense was a rationalist and a materialist and realized that all of this stuff was nothing but superstition. Actually, it's not like that. Even as contemporary science and the Church of Progress took over all of our minds, if not our hearts, and our education is little short of a seminar designed to produce a priesthood for the Church of Progress, beyond and above and beyond all of that brainwashing that we get under the name of education, there was a persistent interest in these subjects. And in fact, even in the Renaissance, the major figures of the Renaissance who are credited with being the forerunners of what became contemporary science were actually much more interested in alchemy, astrology, magic, Kabbalah than they were in what subsequently became science. In any event, Schroller was in the middle of all of this stuff. And in the 20s, he was one of a number of people who set up what nowadays would be called a commune of people who were trying to, let's say, fight the onslaught of the materialist age. And needless to say, they lost this battle. They had a group called Les Veilleurs, which means the Awakeners. And they had a group in a place called Sohalia in Switzerland, where they were trying to put these ideas, effectively they were trying to go back into time. They weren't exactly Luddites, but they believed in handicrafts and in doing things yourself, and also in a traditional point of view. They were spiritual rather than religious. They were not Catholics or Protestants or anything of the sort. They understood that without a spiritual discipline, there is no civilization to speak of. And a number of very interesting people were with Schroller at that time. I'm not sure if he was running this organization or not, but this was somewhere around the late 20s, early 30s. Hans Arp, the sculptor and artist, was a member there. Russell Page, not a name that people are familiar with, but maybe the greatest landscape artist of the 20th century, was part of it. In any event, those were Schroller's formative years, and he was a traditionalist. The motto of his veilleurs was liberté, fraternité, hierarchie. In other words, liberty, fraternity, hierarchy. We'll get into that later on, but he's been accused of being a proto-Nazi and a proto-fascist, and this is actually very untrue. He's accused of being anti-Semitic in an interesting but somewhat poisonous book called Alchemy by an author who actually studied with Schroller briefly before Schroller died, called André Vandenbroek, and in which Vandenbroek accuses Schroller of being anti-Semitic. He wasn't, and there's no evidence in his writings. And since I'm Jewish, I have a pretty good sniffer for real anti-Semitism. I know when it's there. And out of all of Schroller's works, and I've read them all and studied them all, I don't get a whiff really of anti-Semitism, but I do get a sense of a traditionalist who was opposed to virtually everything that we think of as modern and progressive. In any event, the commune in Switzerland broke up, and in 1937, by this time, Schroller realized that Egypt held the ancient secrets. And in 1937, with his wife, he'd made a lot of money, actually, working on helping the Prince Miloš de Ljubić with his finances in some way, shape, or form. And his wife, a beautiful woman, very intelligent, was privately wealthy, so Schroller never had to have a day job. And in 1937, they took off, the whole family, with Lucy, the stepdaughter, along, who was a gifted draftsman, and they went off to Egypt. And Schroller specifically was looking for and interested in trying to pin down an Egyptian knowledge of the golden section, or phi, as it's described, which is a very important proportion in 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, to be specific about it, and used by artists and architects throughout history, supposedly the invention of Pythagoras the Greek in the 6th century BC. Schrolle was convinced that the ancient Egyptians would have known about this, and so he went to Egypt specifically to look for the golden section. Anyway, they were traveling through Egypt, and at Luxor, he had what mystics would call a revelation, and what poets would call an inspiration, and what scientists who want to take all the mystery and all the fun out of everything would call a hypothesis formation. And that hypothesis formation was that Luxor, the Temple of Luxor, the strange asymmetric structure, was a study in harmony and proportion. And so Schrolle was lucky because the French Archaeological Commission was there at the time measuring the temple down to the millimeter. And he was able to demonstrate quite quickly that, sure enough, the Egyptians not only knew about the golden section and the related Fibonacci series, but they also knew about the diatonic scale, the seven-tone scale, and the manner in which they were employing this or deploying this knowledge in this extraordinary temple was infinitely more sophisticated than anything the Greeks would subsequently do. And since the Temple of Luxor is built around 1350 or thereabouts BC, effectively 1,000 years before Pythagoras, and if they knew it then, they didn't invent it then, it must have been in Egypt, Schrolle assumed, which turns out to be correct from the very, very beginning. So it meant that that advanced mathematical harmonic knowledge existed in Egypt long before the Greeks got it from the Egyptians. The Greeks were the first ones to acknowledge, by the way, that their knowledge came out of Egypt. Again, this is another one of those aspects of the Church of Progress conning us into believing that civilization in our sense begins with the Greeks. In any event, Schrolle's studies of the math led him to the symbolism, and the symbolism to the mythology, and the mythology to the astronomy, and then to the medicine. And in the end, Schrolle had, in fact, reformulated in terms accessible to our Western rational minds the entire sacred science of ancient Egypt. In my view, perhaps the most important single work of scholarship of the 20th century, maybe of any century, because it demonstrated a doctrine based upon what Schrolle called the return to the source that integrated religion, philosophy, science, and art into one inextricable whole, exactly the opposite of what we have now. And Schrolle published his books. First, there was a short book, a kind of an introduction to his work called The Temple in Man, and then finally in 1957, an immense volume, three volumes actually, called Le Temple de l'Homme, or The Temple of Man, in which he demonstrated in the most convincing manner imaginable the sacred science of Egypt. This work was not, however, very welcomed in the academic Egyptological community. The head of the French mission at the time, Étienne Drioton, suggested, or in fact counseled, his colleagues that they erect a common wall of silence around this work. And in fact, over the years, that almost worked. Had not been for myself and a couple of other ardent symbolists, Schrolle might still be practically forgotten. And Schrolle might not have survived, let's say, the common wall of silence, or he might not have been able to jump over that common wall of silence. But in fact, nowadays, he's hardly a household name or a household word, but the books are out there, the videos and the movies and the television is out there. In fact, there is a symbolist revival in the making, gathering strength as we go along, week by week, month by month, year by year. This knowledge of an ancient and fabulous sacred science of the distant past is becoming a reality to an increasingly large and enthusiastic audience.
Phoenix Fire!
Surprise! Until we find sponsors for our dedicated ad space, it's still John Anthony West, here to tell you about my personally guided Magical Egypt tours. There's a fascination about Egypt, a glamour, a romance. On my trips, people tell me they've been dreaming of traveling to Egypt since early childhood. There are other wonderful sacred places in the world, Gothic cathedrals, Mayan pyramids, Islamic mosques, Hindu and Buddhist temples. But there is nothing anywhere that matches the grandeur, power, and perfection of Egypt. Yet unless you see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you've not seen Egypt at all. For it is only the symbolist interpretation developed by the brilliant philosopher, mathematician, and alchemist R.A. Shvala de Lubitsch that makes sense of the Egyptian experience. Where establishment academics see only a bizarre, architecturally accomplished but still primitive civilization, Shvala saw and proved that it was based upon a profound and sophisticated sacred science, a science of cosmic principles. One wonders how people come back from Egypt and live lives the way they lived them before, wrote Florence Nightingale back in 1850. The answer is, they don't. 2 weeks in Egypt and you will understand the difference, finally, between true civilization and progress. For detailed information, see my website, jawest.net. Click on Magical Egypt Tours. These are one-of-a-kind trips. There is nothing like them. We find ways to avoid crowds. We meditate in the Great Pyramid. We get into places other people don't get into. The food is great. So are the hotels. The price is remarkably competitive. Just remember, if you don't see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you don't see Egypt at all. Welcome back to Phoenix Fire. We last left our hero, R.A. Shvala de Lubitsch, being cold-shouldered by the academic Egyptological community. And it would have worked had it not been for a few people who were made aware of his work and gradually brought him back into, or not back into, he was never in it, but into public consciousness to a certain extent. My own work was a part of that, you might say, informal movement, but it's been happening and it is happening. But the notion that you build a common wall of silence against solid academic scholarly work that doesn't happen to fit your preconceptions is unfortunately the rule rather than the exception in academic establishments. They are establishments because they are establishments, and the idea is to keep out anything that isn't already in there. In any event, Schwaller's work set up something of a furore back in the 50s. Among Schwaller's champions was Jean Cocteau, the great filmmaker and surrealist, and there was a lively discussion going on in certain literary, not Egyptological, but literary French magazines at the time that eventually got picked up under and put together under the name of La Querelle des Egyptologues, the quarrel of the Egyptologists. And actually there's an appendix in my book, Serpent in the Sky, that details what was going on, the back and forth and the backstabbing and the arguments and so on. Interesting for those who take a real interest in symbolist Egypt, otherwise probably not, but very much so to find out exactly what goes on in these circles and to understand the kind of bitterness and the infighting and what goes on. Anyway, one thing led to another, and I was introduced to Schwaller's work in 1967. I didn't miss Schwaller by that many years, but he was already dead. And I was doing the research for my own first nonfiction book. By the way, just in case you don't know, if you don't know anything about me, and a lot of people don't know this aspect of it, that I didn't start as a as a rogue Egyptologist or a scholar at all, but rather I was a novelist, playwright, screenwriter, essayist, critic, with a lot of things published, never any money made, but interested above all in making fun of the lunatic asylum that I'd been brought up into. In any event, through a strange set of circumstances, I got interested in astrology, and suddenly, more strange circumstances, had a commission to do a book called The Case for Astrology, which was to put together all of the scientific evidence, some of it direct, most of it indirect, that said there was something to this. And I was at that time engaged in one of the schools following the work of the other extraordinary genius of the 20th century, G.I. Gurdjieff. I was living in London by this time, and one of the people in my group mentioned Shrella de Lubitsch, and one thing led to another, and then suddenly there I was, hooked on Egypt, and a long chapter in The Case for Astrology was noted by publishers. Shrella had not at that time been translated out of the French. Suddenly there I was being asked to do a book on Shrella de Lubitsch, and I accepted that happily, because I regarded that, as I said earlier, as perhaps the most significant single work of scholarship of the 20th century. And in doing the work, doing the research for that, interesting, amusing anecdote, my ex-wife had a friend who was related to a man called T.G.H. James, Harry James, he was known as, nothing to do with playing the trumpet, and he was the curator of the British Museum at the time, a very highly respected, advanced, or let's say prestigious position to have, one of the, you might say, one of the top positions in all of Egyptology. And he consented to be interviewed by me, and I wanted to talk about Shrella, of course. And it didn't take long, maybe a sentence or two, when James acknowledged to me, and he said, well, he thought Shrella was quite mad, and that his ideas were completely without foundation. And I was, of course, by this time, pretty well up on my Shrella, and said, well, it didn't seem that he was mad to me. And in fact, there was, oh yes, I think James said, and all Egyptologists simply repudiated his work wholesale. And I said that, well, there was one Egyptologist who didn't, who was as respectable as he was, Arpag Mkhitaryan, who was head of one of the Belgian schools of Egyptology. And Mkhitaryan had counseled, in fact, the lone voice against Drioton's common wall of silence, that this was serious work and it was up to them as Egyptologists to repudiate it if they could. So James thought about that for a moment and he said, ah, yes, well, Mkhitaryan might well say that. He's something of a mystic. End of argument. So since then, I haven't been too worried about what the academic Egyptologists say or think, because this is the attitude that that we run into all the time. Back to Schwaller's work and exactly what is involved in the Temple of Man and exactly what it is that Schwaller did. And what he did was to demonstrate not just the existence of, but the basic principles of what has been known really since Egypt and throughout the Western world as the sacred science. Now, we are brought up to believe that sacred is one thing. In fact, in the Church of Progress, sacred is a rather polite word for superstition. And then there is science, which is the hard facts of reality. That's the real stuff, science. So a sacred science is almost a contradiction in terms. In fact, it isn't, and it's the other way around, actually. It's materialist science that is the superstition, and the sacred science is that which connects, let's say, the metaphysical world with the physical world. Church of Progress terms, there is no such thing as metaphysics. That's another polite word for superstition. But all of the great poets and artists who ever lived would disagree with that, and we'll get into more on this later in a second, actually. The idea that ancient Egypt was the source of a sacred science, and that belief in that sacred science percolated down through the so-called Hermetic tradition from the fall of Egypt on. Egypt disappeared as a distinct entity, as an independent country, with the death of Cleopatra VII in 30 BC. And Egypt broke apart. The religion stumbled on, lurched along for another century and a half or so. Once the Romans took over Egypt and started plundering it, the actual religion, which was already much corrupted, diffuse, degenerated completely, and different aspects of Egypt became different disciplines of the Hermetic tradition: astrology, magic, Kabbalah. This is, of course, the Jewish aspect of it, but related to the Egyptian doctrine itself. Number symbolism, Pythagorean or Platonic philosophy, all of these things were related and percolated down right through Western history, through the Renaissance, and right up to Schwaller's time. I mean, Schwaller didn't invent the sacred science out of the blue. There was a lively renewal of interest in those things. His own particular interest, or one of his particular interests, was alchemy. But all of these things were related. And what Schwaller was able to do was to put all of these things together and show how they were manifested in Egypt through the temples themselves, how a science based upon cosmic principles worked, and what it was possible to do with that kind of an understanding. Now, we have to backtrack here a bit, because the whole notion of principles is something alien to our upbringing and our own education. Our science does not recognize principles as such. There is no talk about principles in our school, and yet it is cosmic principles of various sorts that makes our world comprehensible to us. So let's start with the organic principles, because they're easy and we're all familiar with them. For example, fertilization, gestation or pregnancy, birth, growth, maturity, senescence or old age, death, and renewal are the cosmic principles. These are the organic principles, and according to Schwaller, everything in the universe, from galaxies to nebula to people to germs, anything that is alive, goes through these stages of these cosmic principles, of these organic principles. Now, in Egypt, each of these stages, fertilization, gestation, and so on, was associated with or was embodied in a figure who we call the gods. And we tend to think of these strange animal-headed beings of Egypt as something weird and superstitious and definitely primitive. In fact, it isn't. In fact, it's a very brilliant way of understanding just what these principles are. And when we look, for example, we look at the animals or the insects or the birds that are associated with each one of these principles, we understand why, for example, the hippopotamus is associated with pregnancy or gestation, because what could be more pregnant than a pregnant hippopotamus? The jackal dog is associated with death and embalming, and the journey through the underworld. Each of these strange animal-headed gods has a very specific reason for being chosen to represent that principle. And as soon as we understand that the principles are not the ramblings of the superstitious mind, but rather the genius application of everyday experience, the animals and the birds and the insects, everything that, let's say, make our lives what it is, comprehensible to us, and applies them to the principle, suddenly we understand, even without having to intellectualize it, and certainly the everyday Egyptians did not intellectualize it. It may even be that the priesthood had this knowledge in their guts and could manifest it in these wonderful temples and in all of the art, but if they were asked to explain it to you in a radio program or something of the sort, they might not have been able to do that, because this ability to rationalize and intellectualize seems to be a relatively modern, beginning with the Greeks actually, a relatively modern development, and it is not necessarily an improvement over the symbolic way of looking at things. This becomes very clear when we're in Egypt, by the way, and traveling around from one temple to another, and you understand when you experience the power of these unbelievable places, the way in which the symbolism works upon us subliminally. It has to be explained to us now rationally, of course, but Schwaller actually put these things together. So we have the organic principles, which are the easy ones, and then we have what you might call the metaphysical or the number symbolic principles, and these are not that easy to explain. J.G. Bennett, who was one of the most impressive of the followers of Gurdjieff, and wrote extensively on number symbolism, called numbers the bearers of meaning, the bearers of meaning. So the Pythagoreans carried on this tradition where numbers are not just a way of enumerating, but they are different qualitatively, not just quantitatively. And the way that works, there's a long chapter called Pythagoras Rides Again in My Serpent in the Sky that goes into this. And people tell me, actually, that they get lost when they read it, even though it seems to be simple enough. But it makes more sense when it's explained, ideally on site, in temples, but even here. And it gets complicated as we go up the numbers, but obviously one is unity, but one is not just a number, one is all, the absolute. And then, according to Schwaller, Schwaller talks about what he calls the primordial scission. It's really another way of expressing a Big Bang, except that it is metaphysical and not just physical, in which unity divides, that's the primordial scission, and becomes polarized. It divides into two. Two is a number associated with polarity. This is fairly obvious. Male, female, positive, negative, initiating, receptive, etc., etc., etc. Two becomes three, and the manner in which the numbers proliferate is, again, is demonstrable, rather difficult over the air, but three is a number of relationship or triplicity. We may do a whole show, actually, somewhere along the line, just on the numbers, because the numbers are very interesting. For example, male and female doesn't produce a child. There has to be an affinity. There has to be, let's say, a reconciliation of opposites for manifestation to happen. Four becomes the number of substantiality or substance. These are the four elements of the ancients, who were not stupid enough to think that the actual earth was made up of fire, earth, air, and water. Rather, these were functional ways of understanding these four separate components of what it takes to manifest the physical world. To the ancients, numbers were not just quantitative, they were also qualitative, and the interaction of those qualities produced the universe around us. For example, we see that four is a number associated with substance or substantiality. The ancients talked about the four elements, fire, earth, air, water. They were not referring to actual fire, earth, air, water. The academics tend to laugh at that the ancients believed the universe constructed of these four quantities or qualities, as it were. But rather, to make clear why the ancients used those four elements, we can take a very familiar example of a sculptor who wants to make a statue out of a block of wood. The sculptor himself is fire. He's the fire element, the initiating element. The block of wood is earth. It's the passive element that must be worked upon. The sculptor's idea for the statue is the reconciling element. Without the idea, there is no sculpture. And then there is the sculpture itself, the finished sculpture, which represents substance. It represents something new that was not there before. It's not just the block of wood anymore. It's not the sculptor. It's not the idea. It is something over and above, created from the block of wood. And this is why the four elements are the four elements. Their interplay produces a something, a new substance, substantiality. Now, the numbers are peculiar in the sense that to some, number symbolism is just waffle and nonsense. To others, it opens an insight into the universe, into the world as we know it. But it's one of those strange things. Either you get it, not necessarily right away, or you just don't get it and it looks like nonsense. The Pythagoreans, for example, once Empedocles, one of the Pythagorean followers, is famous for having said, number is all. Schwaller was able to reconstruct the ancient sacred science in its totality. And what becomes clear is that not only were the ancients not the superstitious primitives that we like to believe they were, rather they were in possession of this extraordinary sacred science in which science, religion, philosophy, and art were inextricably intertwined. There was no science that was not religious. There was no religion that was not philosophical. There was no philosophy that was not at the same time art. Exactly the opposite of the pickle we find ourselves in today.
Phoenix Fire!
And now, since heretics also have to eat, here come the ads. Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour in DVD, and more besides. If you can't take a trip to Egypt and experience it firsthand, well, you can't. Not everyone can, but next best, and the closest you can get to experiencing Egypt, is our 8-episode documentary series, Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour. This is the brainchild of my partner, Chance Gardner, a graphic designer and 3D animator of genius, and this series is an absolutely unique visual, emotional, and intellectual media experience. There are innumerable documentaries about Egypt, dry as dust, misleading, repetitive exercises in Egyptological establishmentarianism from the National Geographic or Discovery Channel or some other wielder of the academic cookie cutter. Pretty pictures, nothing ever that feeds the mind, the heart, to say nothing of the soul. This series fills that gap. We explore Egypt in depth. We followed the ramifications into alchemy, the tarot deck, modern DNA research, sacred geometry, the mysteries of ancient technology. There are interviews with leading-edge scholars, scientists, and thinkers, each contributing to a radical revision of our understanding of the past. For more information, go to www.magicalegypt.com. And more. If you've not read My Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, maybe it's time you did. An in-depth introduction to Shwala de Lubitsch's symbolist interpretation. Our Emmy Award-winning classic documentary, Mystery of the Sphinx, now available in an upgraded DVD version. My guidebook, A Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, an invaluable source of information for armchair and actual travelers to Egypt. I have a few copies of my out-of-print first non-fiction book, The Case for Astrology, left for sale. See my website, www.jawest.net. Click on Books.
Phoenix Fire!
Welcome back to Phoenix Fire. As you see, over the course of this program, I've been trying to summarize the magisterial work of R.A. Shwala de Lubitsch, which is a daunting job. What I devote 5 minutes to here, normally I would devote an hour or two there in Egypt at one of the temples where you can actually not just see but experience the great sacred science made manifest and operating upon us emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. As we go along with our Phoenix Fire broadcast, I will probably be devoting whole shows to certain aspects of this extraordinary doctrine. A number, for example, will be a whole program. The gods will be a whole program. The various aspects of the sacred science will be whole programs. So here, we're still summarizing, as it were, and feeling our way into the Phoenix Fire. So what I'd like to do here, actually, is explain, insofar as it's possible, just with words and without the experience, without being there to experience it, why the temples, why sacred art and architecture is what it is, and why it works upon us the way that it does. So let's start with, again, our gods as principles. As we've seen, the gods themselves, the principles, are associated with certain numbers or sets of numbers. For example, Horus and Set represent polarity, the polarity that is unbridged by anything mediating between it. In fact, in the vast Horus-Set myth, It is Horus who ultimately conquers Set and is reconciled to him through the king representing the divine human being. The goddess Hathor, the great mother, is associated with the numbers 7 and 11, also with 4 and 6, but mainly with 7 and 11. The Set is associated with 6 and 8. The various gods and goddesses, for complex reasons, are associated with particular numbers or sets of numbers. Now, the interplay of the gods, or let's say the interplay of the principles, creates the living universe of our experience. And we experience life as this rich interplay of activity, but those activities are, let's say, they can be separated. We experience them as a kind of a web of, let's say, of perceptions. But if we look and analyze our own perceptions, our own experience, we find out that it is made up of the interplay of principles. We just don't think of it that way. We just think of it as life. And in Egypt, however, the gods, each of those specific gods or principles is associated with a number or numbers. Those numbers give rise to the interplay of those of the gods produces the manifest world that we experience, and those numbers give rise to specific geometries, proportions, harmonies, and measures. When there's a living tradition of sacred science, as there was in Egypt, and there was in Greece, and there was actually in medieval Christianity and India with the Vedas, the great mosques are all sacred architecture, and they are built by people who understood to a greater or lesser extent what they were doing, but nowhere is it as clear and as spectacular as it is in Egypt. In any event, what happens when a genius sage architect is producing a temple to be it Hathor or Horus or Amon or whichever god or goddess or sets of gods or goddesses, the geometries, proportions, harmonies, and measures determine the plan of the temple. Genius is essential. You can't just teach this, just as you can't teach playing the violin or you can't teach playing baseball. Without genius, all you can do is copy. So individuality is a part of this, but it is a living tradition. And what happens with a great Egyptian temple, that because of the harmonies, proportions, measures, and so on, when you walk into that temple, the principle, the divine principle, is evoked within us. In other words, we experience the principle. Now, we don't understand, it is no longer our tradition, so we can't say exactly why. An initiated priest probably could have, why you experience a Hathor temple one way and the Horus temple another way and an Amon temple still another way. We just know that they're different. We have our own personal favorites. Some people resonate to one temple, some others to another temple more than something else. But the temples itself, it's very difficult to appreciate, particularly for Americans, because we have virtually no sacred art or sacred architecture here. The great German poet and writer Goethe once described architecture as frozen music. This wasn't just metaphorically or poetically true. It is actually true. The temple, any temple, a sacred temple, is a symphony in stone, and it produces its effect through vibration the same way that normal music does. I mean, we know that music comes to us from sound waves, and we know that music has an emotional effect. Bach does one thing, and Mozart does another thing, and Beethoven does something else, and gangster rap does still something else, and the Star Spangled Banner is something else again, but all of it produces its effect via vibration. We tend not to think of architecture that way, but in fact it is the same. It's let's say, it's a three-dimensional silent stone symphony, and we walk into it, it is vibrating, but we are getting the vibrations visually, actually, and actually more than that, we're getting them viscerally as well, because when you walk into one of these temples, particularly if you get there early in the morning or at lunchtime when almost nobody is there, the effect of these temples is such that it's quite common that people break down in tears, I mean, tears of joy, actually. The experience is almost impossible to imagine for those of, particularly in America, where this is almost unheard of. We get it sometimes out there in nature, if you can find any nature left. But there's very little in terms of art and architecture that has or can have that kind of profound emotional effect. It doesn't work, strangely enough, it doesn't work on the emotionally defective and the spiritually dyslexic. So, strangely enough, those who understand the sacred science and those who promote it to the general public, the academics, the archaeologists, and the Egyptologists, seem, unfortunately, to be the ones who are least susceptible to the experience that is Egypt. In any event, we'll forget about them for the moment. That is how those temples produce their extraordinary effect. It is because they are consciously written stone music, and walking through them, again, you can't appreciate Bach in the middle of the Super Bowl or the supermarket for that matter, but when you get a chance to experience those temples, even in video, they work their magic. And the point of the exercise, as it were, is to the point of real art, of what Gurdjieff used to call objective art, is to connect us to our divine origins. It's as simple as that. In other words, these are not temples where superstitious people prayed for the gods that two and two should make five. They are sites of, in a way, automatic initiation. Simply being there produces, or can produce, an effect that centers us and that tells us, really, what we should be doing with our lives, as opposed to what we're usually doing with our lives, which is trying to figure out how to pay our taxes and put through with all of the unbelievable distraction and hassle of the madhouse that is, in fact, the Church of Progress. So it's not just Egypt, of course. Egypt is perhaps significant. It's not even that Egypt is necessarily the highest expression of the sacred science, but it's the one that we have most access to. Virtually nothing in China or Japan dates back or is complete enough to really experience the way we do Egypt. Medieval Europe, the Gothic cathedrals in particular, are fabulous, and a couple of them are more or less intact. Chartres and Bourges are breathtaking experiences. For me, they were walking into Chartres at the age of 21, and I was in the army in Germany, and walking in there for the first time at dawn on November, when there was absolutely nobody there, was an epiphany. And I understood that at that moment, that whatever it was that I'd been taught in school, and I had absolutely no use for institutionalized religion and still have very little use for it, except at least finally now, years and years, decades later, I understand what those doctrines are supposed to be, no matter how they actually manifest in the contemporary 21st century world. But these are places of revelation. And for me, it was walking into Chartres at the age of 21 that clued me in, that told me, ha-ha, whatever I've been taught was wrong, because whoever put this place up, whoever was responsible, they knew what they were doing. And it was, even though I didn't act upon that right away, it took another, 10, 12 years before I actually started studying the material to learn why it was that this kind of art had that kind of effect, and why mostly what's called art today is some form of self-expression. Most of it is rightfully, seriously negative, and is a kind of a denial of everything the Church of Progress tells us we're supposed to believe in, rightly or wrongly. I mean, in other words, or knowledgeably or not knowledgeably, most of contemporary art is protest. Most of contemporary music is protest. Most of contemporary architecture, unfortunately, is prostitution. Even those architects who have a sense of sacred architecture and would love to be able to practice it for financial constraints, among others, almost don't get the opportunity to do so. Actually, while we're on the subject, very interesting book just come out now by an architect named Herbert Bangs called The Return of Sacred Architecture, in which he analyzes the difference, and in layman's terms, it's not a technical book, in which he analyzes in layman's terms the difference between the sacred architecture of the past, and not even necessarily sacred architecture, even secular architecture based upon harmonic proportions, and what we're used to nowadays with our Walmarts and our Sam's Clubs and our supermarkets and our shopping malls, which are, again, manifestations of the madhouse, particular manifestations of the lunacy of the Church of Progress. When we go into those temples, the stone music affects us and we come out changed. We come out changed, and what we have changed from is our customary indoctrination in our famous Church of Progress. We have encountered in an Egyptian temple a sacred place in which our lives have a cosmic meaning, in which we mean something individually and collectively. We are here to return to the source, as Shvala puts it, and our source is divine. And that is what we experience in an Egyptian temple. The contrast between it and our Church of Progress could not be more clear. And occasionally there are honest churchmen of the Church of Progress who recognize that their doctrine is one of nihilism and despair. Here's a favorite passage of mine from Bertrand Russell, surely a high priest of the Church of Progress, mathematician, brilliant man, good writer even. Here he is. That man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collisions of atoms, that no fire or heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be built. So, there's Bertie on the meaning of life. We are not obliged to accept that, and poor old Bertie seems to be absolutely glorying in the whole uselessness of it all. Here's another quote. Nobel Prize winner Jacques Monod, from a book called Necessity and Chance. The systematic denial of purpose is the cornerstone of the scientific method. Quite possibly it's time to have another think about the scientific method. And so it goes on, with the Church of Progress seemingly doting on its own uselessness and hopelessness, and sometimes actually finding that maybe it's not so bad after all. There's an argument going on in the current New Scientist of intelligent design versus Darwinism. Needless to say, you know what the New Scientist, which point they're taking. And here's a letter that, I won't go into the whole letter, but here's a letter where a correspondent says, many believers literally cannot imagine that atheism is possible, but millions of us enjoy it all day, every day. Well, bully for them. Who would want to talk them out of their atheism? On the other hand, another way of looking at it is that why should the atheists complain? As long as the monkeys have enough bananas, they're not about to complain. But for some of us, bananas notwithstanding, the confinement of the zoo, no matter how comfortable, is an unsatisfactory way of life and undignified too.
Phoenix Fire!
show notes available at www.phoenixfire.blogspot.com. In production by Geraint Hughes, www.thepodule.com. More information on John Anthony West is available at www.jawest.com.